For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm certainly excited to be speaking on the morning show today with two of the best known names and highly regarded names when it comes to fiction and particularly to thrillers and historically based thrillers. And those two names are Steve Barry and Grant Blackwood. They each have written best-selling books, and they have also combined talents, combined forces, combined efforts in a number of collaborative novels, the most recent of which is called Red Star Falling, a Luke Daniels thriller. And we're going to be talking with Steve Barry and Grant Blackwood about the nature of their professional partnership and also talk a bit about this particular novel, which is incredibly exciting, and it is yet another in the series devoted to a compelling character by the name of Luke Daniels, who in turn first emerged from the renowned series devoted to the character of Cotton Malone. And this book is published by Grand Central. And Steve Barry and Grant Blackwood, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning, Greg.
Great to be reconnecting with you. I've had the pleasure of speaking with both of you. I don't remember if I've had the chance to speak with the two of you together, although I know that on at least one occasion I have talked about one of these novels in which you have, in a sense, joined forces. I wonder if we could spend a few minutes talking about your partnership and sort of the way it works. I hope that's not a question you're sick of by now, but I'm sure a whole lot of people are just kind of intrigued about how it is that two people sit down and together write a novel like Red Star Falling.
Well, it's different for everybody. Grant has worked with Jim Rollins, Tom Clancy, and Clive Cussler. So, and then he's worked with me. So he's had four different experiences. So I'll let him come in just a minute and tell you about what the difference between those four are, perhaps. But in our case, we set up a system. The initial novel idea, usually I came up with the actual idea of what I wanted to do. And it would be very vague. You know, I want to go to Russia. I want to have a nuke in orbit. I want to do these kinds of things. I want to have the library of Ivan the Terrible. We kind of go through that little concept. And then we kind of play with an outline of how we'd like it to go. But Grant is not bound by that. It's just suggestions. Then he writes the first draft. He writes the entire first draft all the way through, all by himself. And he does it in his style and his way. He tries to write it in my style. He tries to write it in my voice, but I told him not to worry about that. I said, just write the book. Just write the book and get it out there. If you can make it sound like me, great. If you can't, then that's fine too. But then when he's done, he sends me the manuscript and I rewrite it. And I rewrite it by putting in my voice and the characterization, because Grant knows Luke, but I know Luke better. So I can go in and put in more things. And then we go back and forth and polish it up after that. So it for us, it is a true collaborative effort. It's a joint endeavor where both of us are putting in, you know, equal amount of time to get the thing done. So I'll let Grant tell you about what's the difference between the four people, Grant.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Steve encapsulated our process perfectly. A couple of unique differences are Steve and I have known each other for almost 20 years, and we have very similar sensibilities about thrillers, and we're exactly matching in our idea of what a thriller should do, and that is to entertain the reader. And so we kind of have that same philosophy about thrillers. It's a great process. It's very much two-way. Steve gives me free rein. We touch a base a lot. If I feel like, you know, am I heading down the wrong track? How does this sound? How does this feel? And we kind of course correct as we go. But Steve described the process perfectly. And I think, you know, over two books now, I think the proof is in the pudding. We do a pretty good job at it.
That's for sure. And the numbers, if nothing else, confirm the fact there are so many people who have eagerly, greedily embraced these novels that you have written together. But of course, you also each have written plenty on your own. Grant Blackwood, in particular, I want to ask you, as someone who also has written on your own, solo efforts, novels that have your name only on the cover, you nevertheless seem to be seeking out and embracing this other writing experience in which you are in collaboration with Steve Barry or some of the other renowned writers he mentioned or you mentioned. Is there something in particular that draws you to this particular experience and to make it such an important part of your career?
Well, you know, when I started out, I did not intend to be a co-author. I didn't have anything against the idea. It just didn't occur to me. And then folks started knocking on the door, folks that I respected immensely, that were giants in the business. You know, like Steve and Jim Rollins and Clive Cussler and Tom Clancy, I consider them all, you know, giants in the thriller umbrella. So it's kind of hard to say no. And you get to work with great people who write great thrillers, and I've learned a lot and loved every minute. It's kind of one of those things. I didn't think it would happen this way, but I'm glad it did. Mm.
Steve Barry, I wonder if you could talk about what you most appreciate about Grant Blackwood and what makes him, I'm assuming, a very comfortable partner in these endeavors.
Well, I wanted the Luke Daniels books to be different from the Cotton Malone books. Cotton Malone is action, history, secrets, conspiracies. And we have a niche that we've carved out, and it's been 21 books, and that's where we are. I wanted Luke's series to be a more action adventure. I wanted a little history in there, but I wanted a lot more action and adventure, more Cussler-like in the books. And so when I thought about that, and I knew I couldn't write it by myself because I can't do two books a year. These books require too much research and too much involved. I immediately thought of Grant, because Grant writes action wonderfully. And that's his forte. That's what he does. And so I called him up and said, would you help me out? And he said, yeah. And so I went and got the guy who could deliver what we needed here.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Steve Barry and Grant Blackwood about their latest collaboration, a Luke Daniels thriller called Red Star Falling. Steve Barry, you've just made mention of Cotton Malone, and of course the character of Luke Daniels springs out of those books. It's possible that we have more than a few people listening to this conversation who maybe are not particularly acquainted with either Cotton Malone or Luke Daniels, and it might be good to spell out for them exactly the connection between these two characters. And let's start with Cotton Malone and that incredibly successful series of books. How many have there been by now?
21.
Wow.
The 21st one will come next February.
Very good.
So Cotton is a retired Justice Department agent, lives in Copenhagen, owns an old bookshop, and can't seem to stay out of trouble. So he gets involved in a lot of trouble. It started with the Templar Legacy in 2006, and it's run through this year's book, The Atlas Maneuver. He's a great character. I had a lot of fun with him. And then about 14, 15 books in, I create in the Lincoln Myth, which was a novel that came out, I created a younger character, a guy named Luke Daniels. And Luke is still working for the Magellan Billet, which is a division of the Justice Department where Cotton did work before he retired out. But Luke is now working there, and he's young, and he's brash, and he's eager, and he's impetuous, and he calls Cotton Pappy, which irritates the hell out of Cotton. Cotton calls him frat boy, which irritates Luke. Their relationship is a little gnarly, a little conflicted there for a while, but then they begin to like each other. And Luke came in and out of the Cotton books maybe every other book since about 2013 or so. And then I wanted to spring him out. I said this guy could have his own books. I pitched the idea to Grand Central, and they said yes. So we branched out, and we did The Ninth Man last year. We did Red Star Falling this year, and it has allowed us to develop Luke much more. Luke is growing up. Luke in this book is thrust into Russia alone, except for a Russian agent who's there to help him, who he does not get along with, who is really not helping very much. And he's pretty much on his own, and he's rogue inside Russia, and he's got to use his wits, and he's got to become Cotton in a lot of ways, and he begins to grow here, and that's what we want. We wanted him to grow.
We're speaking with Steve Barry and Grant Blackwood about their newest Luke Daniels thriller, Red Star Falling. As we've already indicated, this novel is largely set in Russia and set in the present day. One of the things that I think would be interesting to talk about is the way in which it feels like the present day and the real world. I mean, there really is a place called Russia and Ukraine and so on. And yet, in your novel, there is no Vladimir Putin, for instance. There is somebody who greatly resembles him. And there is a past leader of Russia that greatly resembles Gorbachev, but not named Gorbachev. And there are other ways in which clearly you are not writing this in a way that is too literally anchored to the present day and to present events. Talk for a moment about what I imagine to be kind of a delicate balancing act in terms of not wanting to be too tied to what is exactly going on in the world as you are sitting down and writing a book like Red Star Falling. And what kind of conversations go on in terms of how much to reflect the present day versus trying to be, in a sense, liberated from that?
That's a very, very fine line we have to walk. And I'll let Grant go into a little more detail of how he did that in his draft. I'll tell you the big picture. We stay 2 years ahead of the reader. So when we write a book, it's 2 years before this book's going to actually be in the reader's hands. So we want to be timely, but we have to be careful not to be too timely, because we don't know what timely is going to be 2 years from now. And this book presented a problem for us because we wrote it a year ago. And so the question is, what was going to happen with the war when we got to publication in summer of 24? We didn't know. So we kind of allude to this conflict in Ukraine, and we allude to things going on there, but we don't go into a great, tremendous detail in that regard, so that we'd have a little wiggle room in case that war had ended and or had been over, which is always everyone's hope. But in this case, it wasn't. The war is still going on just like it was. So we walk a very fine line there to be timely, but not too timely to outdate ourselves. Grant could talk a little bit about some of the details of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of our concerns was, like Steve said, that everything was in flux. Everything still is in flux in a lot of ways. And so one of the things I started concentrating on is that, you know, Luke is not necessarily in a war-torn area, but he's in an area that is an intelligence gray area. And that's kind of what he's doing, is trying to infiltrate earlier. Before this book starts, he and John Vince, the character he's come to rescue in this book, is in Ukraine trying to set up an intelligence network. And so it's a bit of a spy war. And I think that's what we focused on, is Luke's efforts to reconstitute this intelligence network and find John Vince. And so we had this threat of war, but we had this very active spy versus spy war going on that Luke had to navigate.
One of the things that is said about Russia specifically is something about its great area, something that we are not always all that mindful of, I think, in the West. And in some ways, it speaks to the ways in which this can be a difficult place to navigate, both literally and figuratively. I want to read just a brief little portion from the book. You're talking at this point about how many dissidents and journalists and so on have, I was going to say mysteriously disappeared, maybe not so mysteriously, but disappeared for understandable reasons. And then you write, with a population of 150 million and a landmass of 17 million square kilometers, Russia held half the people of the United States with almost twice the space. Building and running secret facilities was laughably easy. That vastness had always driven the Americans crazy. Finding an ICBM site in 2.5 million square kilometers of dense Siberian forest made the proverbial needle in a haystack look like a toddler's game. I think even if somebody has a decent acquaintance with world geography, it might not necessarily still occur to them that the vastness of the nation of Russia would pose these kind of challenges when it comes to the work of agents in a novel like Red Star Falling. I'm just curious how and when that realization kind of came to you, that would be an interesting point to make, and how that makes Russia, in a sense, a great backdrop for these kind of mysteries and thrillers.
Well, it came in the very beginning because we knew Russia was huge. We knew it was big, and we wanted to use that bigness, and we wanted to use that to our advantage. And Russia's always used its geography to wreak havoc with the West. It always amazes me why they want more territory when they have so much territory, but yet they want more and more and more, and it just makes no sense with what you've got. We have some locales in this book, though, that are very interesting. Locales that, frankly, a couple of them I never even knew existed. Grant found most of those, so I'll let him talk about how we picked these locales.
You know, you've got a wealth of places to choose from, and so what I started looking for is places that were historically interesting, geographically interesting, places that readers probably knew nothing about, and we could tie into not just the story, but the history of Russia. For example, one of those places is a tiny, tiny island that has a wonderful monastery on it up in the White Sea, not far from Archangel. And very few people have heard of it. I didn't know about it until I found it. And so you look for those kind of things that fit the plot and the history and the culture of the place. But, you know, as Steve said, you think about the United States, we have four time zones. Russia has nearly three times that many time zones. Vast majority of it is rural. And, you know, people notice foreigners there. And so Luke is moving in a large environment that can be hostile at a moment's notice. But our problem wasn't finding interesting locations. Our problem was narrowing them down. Hmm.
I read someplace that the two of you both have visited Russia, and I would be curious to know a little more about your visits to Russia. I assume they were not just sort of pleasure trips, but in a sense professional working trips in terms of wanting to understand this nation and so on. I'd be curious to know that about your time spent in Russia, and maybe in a real tangible way how your writing has benefited from having actually been to Russia and actually walked its streets.
I've been twice, and once early on in the 90s, right after the fall. It was a very different place. I went back about 14 years later. It was a very different place than it was then. So
I actually got the idea from my novel, The Romanoff Prophecy, while I was there. So I researched that novel, and I was also doing research on the Amber Room when I was there. So I got to see it twice, and it's a really remarkable place. And it's a shame it's not more open. It's a shame that it's not more able to be visited. It's not something that they're really interested in. It's too bad, because there's a lot there to savor. And I would love to go back and see more of the country, particularly the locales in this novel. That monastery up on the White Sea, I'd love to go see. The island where the prison used to be, I'd love to go see, because that prison used to be there. And I'd love to go up to Archangel. I'd like to go up and see the republic that we deal with in there. There's an independent republic within Russia, which I never knew even existed. These are all places I would love to go see. Unfortunately, it's not possible now. Grant was there, and he got to meet with some folks.
Yeah, I was there in 2006, and I met with some former KGB officers for a book I was working on. And one thing that I really took away, and it kind of haunted me in a good way when I was writing this book, is that when I was walking around Moscow, which was arguably the most cosmopolitan town or city in Russia, I found people staring at me, avoiding me. And I asked my escort, why is that? And they said, well, they know you're an American. And I said, well, how? They said, the way you carry yourself, the way you present yourself, you look people in the eye, you walk with your head up. Those are all indicators that you're an American. Now, what I did is thought, what must it be like for Luke Daniels to move through a rural world where you stand out even more and you're playing a spy versus spy game? So how must that be for him? So that was always in the back of my mind, is that he was a disavowed agent who would end up in a gulag or dead if he looked too American.
I want to mention a delicious little detail that comes up in I guess we call it chapter 22, and this is at a point when Luke Daniels is making his way through Russia relatively early on in this rescue mission to try and rescue his comrade and colleague. And I just want to read this little portion, that I'd love to hear more about how you came to know this kind of information. So he is driving, and it's time to find a gas station. And we read these words: refueling was tricky in Russia. He'd been trained in the do's and don'ts. Do use one of the national brands like Gazpromneft, which had over 1,000 stations. Diluting gas was a national pastime, so don't go to a station where there were few people to know people, as that indicated the locals knew the gas was bad. Do pour a little into the palm of your hand. If it evaporates fast, then it's good. If not, the longer it takes, the more water it contains. Don't allow the tank to drop below half full. Do fill up at every opportunity, as you have no idea when the next opportunity might come along. Gas stations in East Russia were sparse, but the farther west they went, the more they saw. I don't know if one is likely to read that in the typical tourist guide or even in a book about Russia, but I just love that little tidbit of information that kind of helps us see one important, if also relatively mundane, facet of daily life in Russia. Do you happen to recall how you came across that?
Yeah, that was my contribution. I have a friend of mine who's an active intelligence operative, and he told me about it. He physically has done it. And he said, you got to watch the gas over there. You got to watch everything, because they just water it down to no good. Got to be very careful. And he told me all of those things that you just said, and I included them in the novel. It was wonderful, because he has physically done it himself.
Before we dig into some details related to the story of this new Luke Daniels thriller, again titled Red Star Falling, I'd love to just explore a couple of more general points in terms of how these books are written, and maybe the flavor specifically of these Luke Daniels thrillers. Mr. Barry, I have heard you say, or I've read in an interview, that you very much prefer what is called oblique dialogue. and you think that is really the best way to go when it comes to writing a thriller like Red Star Falling, and particularly when it comes to conveying important information. First of all, explain to our listeners what that term oblique dialogue means, and then the way in which you like to utilize that in your writing.
Well, I don't like direct questions and answers in dialogue, and I don't like a lot of dialogue. That's another part of my style. My characters talk when they absolutely need to talk. If they don't need to talk, they don't. Oblique dialogue is the best for me. It would be like when my wife would come back from shopping and she would have a Chanel bag in one hand and a Louis Vuitton bag in another hand coming in the store, in the house. And I would ask her, well, what you got there? You know, and she said, well, I've been shopping. I said, well, how much did you spend? She would say, did you know there was a wreck out on the interstate today? And I just couldn't, traffic was terrible. It was just terrible. And I said, well, I didn't ask you that. How much did you spend here today? She said, how was your day today? Did you do all right today? What did you get there? Oblique dialogue is where you're not answering the question, but you are answering the question. And oblique dialogue is fun because it keeps the reader engaged. As you see this little bit of conflict in the dialogue, that's my style. And this is one of the things that I told Grant. I said, Grant, I know that's not your style, so don't worry about it. Just do what you've got to do, then send it over to me, and I'll oblique it up. And that's what I do in the rewrite. I do a lot of obliquing up. I did ask, though, let's don't have people just talk. Let's have them only talk when they need to talk. And so... that's just one of my little quirks that Grant has to adapt to.
I have to say, that style reminds me a little bit of the classic old television series Mission Impossible. I have a feeling there's never been an hour-long television drama that had fewer words, I mean less dialogue, than Mission Impossible, because in so many cases they're engaged in important work and there's really nothing to talk about. And that's talking right. Too much and would actually be counterproductive.
I love that show, and I know exactly what you mean. Same way. I just don't like a lot of chit-chat. I like them to talk when they need to talk.
Something else I want to ask you about in a kind of a more general nature is the fact that, as is the case in just about any thriller that involves, you know, espionage and so on, is there is some violence. But compared to some thrillers, compared to some books that touch on these kind of topics in really dangerous places in the world, this is not a very blood-splattered novel. And when violence occurs, and in particular when death occurs, it's often terrible, shocking, has deep impact. But it's not like every other page has yet another murder. I wonder to what extent that is a conscious decision, and if it is a conscious decision, what's that about?
It is a conscious decision. I do not like a lot of gratuitous violence in my books at all. I have violence. We have to. Killing is kept to a minimal, only when necessary, usually at the end when the bad guy gets what's coming to them. It's just a part of the style that I have. And this is one area where Grant and I kind of ran into each other a little bit. Tell them about that, Grant.
Well, you know, I know Steve's audience is different. I think, you know, I kind of immerse myself in what it might be like to be an Army Ranger who comes into civilian life. And Luke is a smart fellow, but he did tours in Afghanistan as a Ranger. And their default mode is when you're attacked, you act, period. And unfortunately, over there, violence sometimes did solve a lot of problems. And so that was my default mode going in. But we corrected pretty quick, I think, in the Ninth Man. And Steve would text me and say, you know, you need to pull back on the gunfighting a little bit. And I would do that. And I think we found a happy medium, and it worked well.
Mm. And that's where his action-adventure, that's part of it. And I try not. They did a study of my readership a few years ago, and it came back 50-50 men and women, which is really good. That's what you really want. And I think part of that for the women is I don't have a lot of that violence and that gratuitous violence, so I'm very careful. I'm also a very big bestseller in France, and they love their thrillers without violence.
over there. But Germany, I can't give away a book because they like violence in their books. So each country is a little bit different. And my friend Lee Child, who writes the Jack Reacher series, is just the opposite. He sells a lot of books in Germany because the Reacher books are very violent and can't do much. He doesn't do very well in France.
Interesting. We're speaking with Steve Barry and Grant Blackwood about the latest Luke Daniels thriller. It's titled Red Star Falling. I'd like to give one of you the opportunity to summarize in a minute or less kind of the heart and soul of Red Star Falling, and then we're going to explore just a few details.
You want me to do it or you, Grant?
You go right ahead.
Oh, I figured you were going to say that. I was hoping.
Yeah.
I would say this book encompasses three elements. The first element is Russia itself, big Russia. We've talked about that. The second element is the lost library of Ivan the Terrible, which is a fantastic collection of books that disappeared 500 years ago. And it is, I've been wanting to put that in a novel for a long time. And the third element is the legend, persistent legend that came out of the fall of the Soviet Union, that the Soviets put a nuke in orbit before everything went to hell there. No one knows if that's true or false, but there is a pervasive legend that that may have happened. I read about that and I said, well, what if they actually did it? So these three elements made the book. But what's cool about this book is you think this is about one thing until you get about 90% in, and then there's a twist and you go, uh-oh, that's not what I thought this was about. I thought this was over there. So this is a nuke in orbit with a twist. And that's what makes this interesting. We did not foreshadow the twist or give any warning that the twist was coming, because neither one of us knew about the twist till we got there. We actually created it when we got to that point, because we said, whoa, wait a minute, we can go here. Why don't we? So that's what we did. So there is a twist to the book. And then there's a second twist at the very end. So there's a double twist in the novel, and that's what we want.
I was going to say,
Greg. In broad terms, The Ninth Man, the first Luke Daniels book, is a great action-adventure book, and it had a really cool premise. But I think in Red Star Falling, we really hit our stride when it comes to action-adventure. I think readers are really going to notice, not necessarily a difference in quality, but the ramp-up we did in action-adventure in Red Star Falling is a ramp-up, I think.
I would agree. Let's talk for a moment about this fabled lost library of Ivan the Terrible. And we should probably, it's the kind of thing where when you first are reading this, this sounds like the stuff of fiction, and in fact, it's not. In fact, we're talking about someone who really lived, and we know with a fair degree of certainty that this amazing collection of books existed as well, and just exactly where it is, if it still exists, is, of course, unknown. Tell us more about this book collection and extraordinary man to whom it belonged, the first Tsar of Russia, known as Ivan the Terrible.
Yeah, Ivan was the first man to, he assigned that title to himself, Tsar of all Russia. He was, now terrible doesn't connotate in his time to what that word means today. That really meant feared. So it was Ivan the Feared, but they called him Terribili, which in Russian was translated over to terrible. Now, he wasn't a very nice guy. He had some serious problems. He eventually murdered his own son. He suffered from paranoia. He had a lot of issues. But he was an able ruler of Russia, and Russia required an iron fist at that time. He was a book lover. The books, their initial collection came from his mother, who was a Byzantine. She had come from Constantinople to marry his father, Ivan the Great, and the books came with her. We don't know how many. The best guess is around 130 to 150. There are accounts of people who actually saw the library, and this is all we know about it. The manuscripts were one of a kind. We don't have any of those today, of what we know was seen in there. And we put a list of those in the novel. So there's a little bit of a list of what we know the book, what the library entailed. How to incorporate it into a thriller, though, was much more problematic, and Grant came up with the idea of how to do that. So Luke has to find the library, then he has to find one particular book in the library, and then he has to stop Red Star from falling. He has three goals that he has to achieve. And I think Grant came up with a good idea and a good way to do it, and it works out really well how the library plays an integral role in this adventure.
And Grant Blackwood, I suspect you don't want to reveal too much of that, but maybe you could just say a word about the challenge of trying to connect two things that are seemingly worlds apart. I mean, at a glance, having absolutely nothing in common with each other and finding some sort of common link. How does one go about sort of solving that conundrum?
Well, one of the people that Luke has to deal with and manage as, you know, a spy recruiter is a kind of unstable gentleman. And one of the things CIA case officers have to do is figure out what motivates somebody, what drives them, what's important to them. And it comes down to Luke finds out what's important to the person he needs help from is the lost library of Ivan the Terrible. I won't tell you how it's important or why, but it becomes very important. And so solving that problem solves one of Luke's problems, and that's what he does.
So one of the things we have not yet really mentioned is that we have at the heart of this novel the present-day leader of Russia, one Konstantin Franko, who very much resembles Vladimir Putin, but in fact is not literally Mr. Putin, and then a past leader of Russia, one Alexei Delov, who would very much resemble Gorbachev. And relatively early in the novel, there is a memorable conversation between the two of them and their contrasting visions of what Russia's future should be could not be more different. I just love the way this scene was written, and one can well imagine how two intelligent men, both caring about their country, could have such vastly different visions of what their country is all about. Can you tell us a little more about how you came up with this particular conflict of vision?
Well, we envision what would have occurred if Gorbachev and Putin had talked to one another. What would that conversation have been like? That's exactly what we recreated here with our two fictional characters. You know, what would these two men have said to one another who had completely different thought processes? And we knew we had to have this confrontation very early in the book so that the reader understands the motivations of Alexei. You know, and what he, you know, why he goes forward, what's the crucible, what we call it, the thing that gets a character to do what they normally would never do. Alexei's not a murderer. Alexei's not an evil person. He's a good character. He's a good president. He brought Russia out of the Soviet Union, away from communism years ago. Now he's watching Russia crumble into nothingness, going back to where it came from. And what would force him, what would compel him to go forward? And that's where that kind of came from. And then Grant fashioned that. Talk a little bit how you put that together, Grant.
You know, it was pretty easy because Delov and Franco have diametrically opposed visions for Russia, so much so that we had Konstantin Franco reconstituting the Gulag system in Russia. That's kind of, for me, that epitomizes the kind of man he is. And then you have a decent man in Delov who is faced with an impossible choice. And he is a man with limited time to make right what he sees is Russia sliding back into totalitarianism. And once you get two people that are powerful and influential and willing to do just about anything to see their vision fulfilled, that's the best kind of conflict you can get.
In that conversation, at one point, the present-day leader of Russia, again, Konstantin Franko, says these words, "If history has taught us anything, it is that Russians do not know what they want until it is handed to them. This nation has been dominated for centuries, first by Mongols, then Tsars, and finally communists. Russians do not crave democracy. They seek authority. They deserve to live in a land they can be proud of, not one that goes hat in hand to Western powers begging for peace." And Alexei Delov comes back, "And you are going to give them pride with war?" And Franco replies, "Small prices to pay in the grand scheme of things." I just wonder, I guess I'm asking for your own opinion, for all you have studied Russia and the Russian people, is there some sad truth to the words that you have the character of Konstantin Franko saying here?
No, they're exactly true, and sadly they are true. Russian, if you're going to have totalitarianism in this world, the one place you could have it and get away with it is Russia, because they are very accustomed to it. The democracy is a completely alien concept to them, and there's no way we're going to be able to impose that over there. And that's the problem. All we can hope for is we get a benign dictator, somebody like a Gorbachev or somebody like that, who, you know, does not go out and want to do the kinds of things that Putin does now. But unfortunately, Russia is just that. It's a country to be dominated, and it has been dominated and will continue to be dominated. That's what makes it the most unpredictable and dangerous place in the world.
Another favorite moment for me in your novel is something when we're sort of stepping inside the head of your main character, Luke Daniels, as he is contemplating the necessity of rescuing his friend, John Vince, who has been captured by Russian operatives. And he had made some choices in that dramatic moment, just when John Vince ultimately is apprehended by the Russians, and he's all this time later still sort of stewing in regret. And at one point you have Luke Daniels thinking to himself, "The shoulda, coulda game never made him feel better. Truth is, nothing he could have done would have prevented John's capture. That was logic talking, but guilt was death." I think you're really touching on something that, of course, is true for just about all of us, even those of us not engaged in international espionage or some of the dramatic life and death escapades of someone like Luke Daniels. But I really appreciate that human insight that you share in that moment. And it reminds me that one of the things that I think is distinctive about novels like Red Star Falling is that there is a real humanity in these pages. And it seems to me that you are careful to try to make these characters human beings, maybe not exactly like the rest of us, but subject to some of the same sorts of feelings like regret. Could you just talk about the importance of that? I mean, that's not the kind of thing that probably makes the headlines when it comes to this kind of literature, but it seems to me it must matter to you because we find it in the pages of your books again and again.
That line you read is Grant, so I'm going to let him take that. That's his words.
You know, I think a lot of people feel that way, whether they're intelligence operatives or in special forces like Luke Daniels. But, you know, his mindset is you never leave somebody behind. You just don't leave them behind on the battlefield. But he was torn between saving his friend John Vince and serving the broader purposes of the mission. And in the end, he had to opt for the latter. And that broke his heart because he knew what was going to happen to John Vince, or had a good idea. John Vince was either going to get a bullet in the skull or he was going to end up in a gulag that would probably kill him either way, and he had to let his friend go. And that just tore him apart and haunted him. And so 2 years later, when Luke gets a chance to go back in and not just, you know, assuage his guilt, but make it right and save his friend, he jumps at it.
Hmm. Another human touch in this novel is that the former leader of Russia, Alexei Dilov, who figures very prominently in kind of the central story, is not only dismayed by the direction that his native land is taking, but he is also facing a health crisis that is going to end his life very soon, glioblastoma. And you certainly vividly depict what he is experiencing with this. And I think it's such an interesting choice, and I suspect it was a careful choice in terms of blending this into the story of Alexei Dilov.
Yeah, we needed an ailment that was going to be fatal, graphic, and affect his cognitive abilities. And so we had to have that. And Grant, I remember we talked about it, and Grant said, I'll find it. And Grant found it. Tell him about it.
Well, that's one of those things that you worry about your Google searches as an author, is you look for terrible ways for characters to die. And we came across this one pretty quick, and we agreed, Steve and I, that this was the right one, because it's a terrible thing to witness on the page, but it also, like Steve said, it does affect one's cognitive ability. And so Dilov had to do something pretty terrible. He plans to do something pretty terrible. And he wonders if he's doing the right thing, but he has great resolve. And he has underlings who trust him implicitly, but they also wonder if he's doing the right thing. And so that illness not only served as a ticking clock, but I think a kind of a moral centerpiece to what Dilov felt he had to do.
Exactly. And of course, yet another very compelling character in your novel is Alexei Dilov's faithful bodyguard, Edmund Grishin, who finds himself wondering if this man to whom he is wholeheartedly devoted is in a position to make these kind of life and death choices. And when he is choosing, for instance, to do something daring, is this an effect of this disease that is attacking his brain? And again, even for a regular person in so-called regular life, we can imagine that kind of thing being a point of great difficulty and uncertainty. And of course, that's part of what's going on in this novel as well, wrestling with uncertainty, wrestling with difficult choices, and looking at a future that is full of unknown. The novel, again, is Red Star Falling. It is the second Luke Daniels thriller, and it is co-written by Steve Barry and Grant Blackwood. And can your fans look forward to yet another Luke Daniels thriller in the future?
Yes, there'll be a third one. We're working on it now. It'll be something very interesting that I've been wanting to do for a long, long time. But Luke Daniels is going to get hooked up with Walt Disney. Walt Disney will figure into this book. Disney took a trip to South America in the 1930s as part of a goodwill tour that the State Department sent him down there, but they also asked him to keep his eyes and ears open while he was there. And some very interesting things come out of that trip and lead to a modern-day Luke Daniels adventure. We're working on it now.
Wow. Well, I can't wait. And in the meantime, this latest Luke Daniels thriller is called Red Star Falling, published by Grand Central, and again, the work of the collaboration of Steve Barry and Grant Blackwood. Steve Barry, Grant Blackwood, thank you for being my Morning Show guests today. It was great to catch up with you. Best wishes on all your future writing.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it.
Monday on the Morning Show, and interview originally scheduled to air last Monday with an Atlantic Monthly writer, a collection of odes called Get Me Through the Next 5 Minutes. Next Tuesday, Art Sear joins us for his monthly visit to the program. and on Wednesday, one of the co-creators of the organization, Better Angels. Partly sunny and seasonal conditions today, a 40% chance of rain, particularly this afternoon, a high today of 83 degrees, cooler near the lake. Partly cloudy overnight, 30% chance of rain, low of 68. Tomorrow, cloudy, hot and humid, high of 87. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.